Our first case of the day is 013485, Viacom Inc. et al. Versus Sumitomo Corporation et al. And it's Mr. Smith. Good morning.
May it please the Court. My name is Reggie Smith, and I represent the appellants in this appeal, Viacom Incorporated and Emerson Electric Company. Viacom and Emerson are first purchasers of hundreds of millions of pounds of copper cathode that purchase cathode based on contracts that are tied expressly by term to exchange prices as published on the commodities on the New York Commodities Exchange Market, the COMEX, for copper cathode.
Does it matter if they are first purchasers of cathode but not first purchasers of the raw ore from which the cathode is then made?
Your Honor, I think there is a significant distinction there. In this particular case, the allegation made by the plaintiffs below is that these defendants, Global Metals and Credit Lyonnais Rouse, conspired with Sumitomo Corporation, who is the world's largest trader of copper cathode, to manipulate the market price of that specific commodity. Sumitomo Corporation does not trade in copper raw materials, does not supply copper raw materials to any of its purchasers, nor did Global Metals, in the course of this conspiracy, sell copper raw materials. Also, in the evidentiary record below, it is clear from correspondence between Sumitomo Corporation and Global that the target of the exchange manipulation conspiracy here was specifically to move the price of physical copper cathode in the cash market higher. There is no excuse me, Your
Honor. I was just going to say, so by analogy, perhaps, this isn't going to be a perfect analogy, but if there were a conspiracy among manufacturers of automobiles to fix the price of automobiles, you would be looking for the first purchaser of a car, and you wouldn't care where the car manufacturers got their engines from.
I think that would be an apt analogy, Your Honor. Another analogy in the commodities market would be if there is a conspiracy to move the price of gasoline, for example, higher. The price, which is quoted on a commodities exchange for gasoline, may well affect and move the price of crude oil, for example, which is a critical input into gasoline, higher in the commodities market. It may adversely affect buyers of crude oil. Nonetheless, for antitrust standing purposes, the party who purchased the gasoline, which is the specific product that is the target of the conspiracy, owns the antitrust claim. It would not be the purchaser of the underlying raw material. It's also important to note that defendants' own experts, Dr. Kenneth Arrow from Stanford University, testified specifically that in this case, the impact on raw materials purchasers from the defendants' conspiracy was indirect, because the direct impact of the conspiracy was on buyers of copper cathode, which was the specific product that was the target of the conspiracy. It's all...
Yeah,
yes, Your Honor.
But, I mean, although the, you know, the future market clearly affects the cash market, it seemed as if it's much less clear what the effect might be on a particular transaction. And that, I think, you know, was the district court's problem with your view of things. And did you provide the court with any particularized examples of transactions in which the alleged wrongdoing had the type of direct effect on the price paid? And if so, where can I find it?
Okay, Judge Rovner, we did. And I agree that the district court express an opinion that evidence was not in the record, and we respectfully disagree vehemently with that. You need look no further than the contracts at issue in this case. Both Westinghouse, which is the predecessor in interest to Viacom, and Emerson had specific contracts with their suppliers, companies like Asarco, Phelps Dodge, that tied specifically by price term the purchase price to the published exchange price on the COMEX. The link could have been no more direct. You can find that in the record appended to the affidavits of John McGill, the lead copper buyer for Westinghouse, and for Matt Palazzolo, the lead copper buyer from Emerson. It was a contractual link that could not have been any more direct. Your Honor, also from a market standpoint, We presented affidavit testimony of Larry Goetz. Mr. Goetz was the head of Exxon Corporation's copper buying operations and copper selling operations. Mr. Goetz, who has 35 years of experience in the copper market, said that copper cathode prices are set directly by published exchange prices.
There How much is at stake in the lawsuit in New York City brought by the futures traders?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, how much was at stake?
Yeah, how much money is involved in that?
I do not know the demand by class counsel Mr. Lovell in that action. I do know that Sumitomo Corporation and Global, and I believe now Credit Leone Rouse, have settled claims associated with impact on futures traders on the COMEX. But, Your Honor, those injuries are clearly independent of the injuries to my client, and this court has so
well,
held...
Well, there's this issue of who is the best plaintiff to bring these lawsuits. I think that's one of the issues. And the most direct impact is on the futures traders.
Well, Judge Cuddy, we would respectfully disagree that the most direct impact was on...
Now, your reliance here is almost 100% on Sander, and I'm the author of that opinion, so I guess I don't object to it, but... it involved an agricultural commodity without any of these complications that we're talking about here. And the issue is, should we extend it, it seems to me, to this kind of a situation? Isn't this a slippery slope? Aren't we, you know, going one step at a time and running into the Illinois brick problem more and more as we go along?
Judge Cuddy, I would posit that this case is a far stronger example of where cash market participants should have standing than the case that was presented in Sanner, and let me explain. There is very specific evidence in this record that was ignored by the district court that these defendants intended by their conduct to manipulate the cash price for copper cathode. It cannot be ignored that Sumitomo Corporation is not in the business of making money on futures transactions for copper cathode. They are a physical cathode supplier. The district court discussed not in one sentence the fact that Sumitomo Corporation and Global Metals entered into minimum price contracts for the supply of copper cathode from Global to Sumitomo that were tied to the exchange prices. For every penny increase of manipulation in the exchange price, Sumitomo Corporation profited as a result of that activity.
But can you identify with specificity what evidence you presented to the district court that would establish that the prices in the physical and futures market moved in tandem? Can you do that?
Yes, Your Honor. The first piece of evidence I would point to is the supply contracts. The supply contracts reflect a penny-for-penny relationship between exchange prices on the COMEX and futures prices. Number two, the affidavit of Larry Goetz. Again, an individual who has 35 years of experience in this market, and I would note that none of defendants' experts have one day of experience in the physical copper markets. He testified specifically by affidavit that exchange prices set copper cathode prices in the cash market. You need look no further than the annual reports of the two largest producers of physical copper cathode in the United States, Phelps Dodge Corporation and ASARCO. In those annual reports, they state specifically they are price takers. In other words, they take the price as published on the exchange, and that is the price they charge for copper cathode. There is no discretion in this market as it is developed. Copper cathode is sold at a price that is linked directly and expressly to the exchanges. And the defendants knew this, and they took advantage of this relationship through the minimum price contracts. The minimum price contracts allowed these defendants to manipulate the exchanges and in turn profit in the cash markets. The correspondence, and keep in mind that the appellants here were prevented by the district court as a result of bifurcation of discovery from getting into the merits of the underlying conspiracy. But the documents that were produced early on in the litigation are very damning in terms of showing a very clear intent by Yasuo Hamanaka, the chief trader for Sumitomo Corporation, and David Campbell, the principal of Global, to manipulate the cash price of copper cathode in the exchange markets in order to profit in the cash markets. It is a rare antitrust case where you will actually see graphically, in graphs that are shown, that if you move the price from this level to this level, we will profit on the physical transactions associated with the sale of copper cathode.
These suppliers have their own, some of them have their own lawsuits, don't they?
Actually, Your Honor, none of these suppliers brought an affirmative action in connection with this manipulation. It is true that three of the suppliers, integrated producers of copper cathode, when invited by these defendants as part of an indirect purchaser class settlement in California, submitted proofs of claim and were paid. Of course, it would be an odd result that the defendants, through strategic settlements, can eliminate the standing of parties who clearly were injured and the first parties that were injured by the misconduct. The fact that these defendants invited the Asarcos of the world and the Kennecotts of the world to submit claims in connection...
The fact that you're injured is hardly an adequate answer to the standing question. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of people are injured here.
No doubt, Your Honor, and the question that's presented clearly for this court is whether our clients were the first parties that were injured, and we would argue clearly that they were, because our clients...
Isn't it also an issue, are they the best parties to maintain this antitrust lawsuit?
I think that is a very relevant inquiry, Your Honor, and we would say that they are, because our clients, again, are first purchasers of the very product that was the subject of the conspiracy. This court, as you well know, Judge Cudahy, in the Sanford opinion, said you can have parties in both a futures market that were injured and in a cash market that were injured who sustain independent injuries and both own a cause of action. I would present to this court that there is no rationale for a finding that parties that speculate in the futures markets, for example, and were injured as a result of short positions that they took by the defendant's conduct, are any more directly injured than our clients in this case.
Because Sanford was a dismissal of a complaint as opposed to a summary judgment. I don't know whether Sanford may have passed summary judgment.
I don't know the answer to that question either, Your Honor. I do know that you outlined some very, very clear guidelines as to whether standing would or would not exist in the cash market, and the evidence is overwhelming in this case, and unfortunately was essentially ignored by the district court below, that not only the intent of the conspiracy was to manipulate the cash price of cathode, but also that there is a direct linkage, and I would argue an even more direct linkage than existed in Sanner, between exchange prices and cash prices for cathode, because you have the contracts.
So we have the supply contracts, we have Larry Gibbs. What else have we got?
You've got the CFTC finding that there were the pricing relationship between the futures and the cash markets are well known and well established. The defendants in their briefing do point out correctly that is not a binding finding by the CFTC, but clearly it is admissible evidence. You also have the annual reports of Asarco, of Phelps Dodge. You have the affidavits of Mr. McGill and Mr. Palazzolo that explain that when they were buying copper cathode, they were presented with a single price, and that price was the exchange price.
And it was a particular exchange price? It was that monthly settlement price? I mean, because the district court commented there are actually quite a few different prices that the exchanges generate.
There are, Judge Wood, and in this particular contract, the testimony below, and it's borne out by the terms of the contract. Westinghouse bought copper cathode at the COMEX monthly average settlement price. Emerson bought on the spot market at the monthly average settlement price, but also did forward price a certain percentage of its production. But again, that is a published COMEX price that was affected by the manipulation. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time, Your Honor, so
I'll... Okay. Mr. Habellis? You've divided your time with Mr. Wolowitz.
Yes, I represent Global Minerals, Your Honor, and Mr. Wolowitz, Credit Lyonnais Rouss. Your Honor, Peter Habellis, on behalf of Appellee Global Minerals. Let me make an observation first about the record to get into the issues that you were asking lastly about Mr. Smith, and then I want to get back to some of the first purchaser issues, if I may. The evidence, first with Mr. Getz's affidavit, which Mr. Wolowitz has at page 310 of the supplemental appendix, the confidential version that was filed by appellants, makes no reference whatsoever to either Emerson's or Westinghouse's contracts. He spoke of his general industry experience, which was only working for a company that made copper concentrates for a period of time. Secondly, he refers to the contracts. There was extensive deposition and document testimony taken from both the appellants and the various vendors. And what Judge Crabb did was look at the record that showed how those contracts were actually implemented, how they performed under them, as opposed to the terms that tied it supposedly to COMEX, much like in the beef antitrust case where we had the yellow sheets, and then the court looked at the evidence of how the yellow sheets were actually used.
Is there any evidence that Mr. Smith just noted that Judge Crabb missed completely?
No, because, and let me try to answer that question by pointing to the evidence that Mr. Smith noted and what it was. The evidence that was put in by the appellant in opposition to summary judgment were generalized affidavits from Mr. Palazzolo, Mr. McGill, that said, we purchased based on COMEX.
But there's also the contract. I mean, that's what worries me, and it seems to me that what we need to examine is whether there are genuine issues of material fact. I think you're approaching this as something akin to, you know, 12b1 jurisdictional facts that get resolved once and for all up front. But it strikes me that there is a fair amount of evidence, starting with the contract, that suggests that these prices did move in tandem and that the district court's hypothesizing about discounts never happened. I mean, maybe hypothetically it could, but if it didn't ever happen.
Well, actually, no, Your Honor. With all due respect, the evidence was developed on both of those fronts. First, with respect to the contracts, let me use Emerson as an example. Mr. Smith said they bought at the spot market. In fact, the testimony we put in from the buyers from Emerson showed that they bought virtually all of their copper on a forward basis, and they started based on the exercise of their discretion 2 years in advance of a delivery month to forward price. Now, there was no formula. There was no reason. They could have done 5% 2 years ahead. They could have done 20%. So you ended up having this amalgam of a price that represents their prediction of where the market's going based on futures contracts that are trading 10, 12, 16, 18, 20, up to 24 months out.
Right.
And then the second thing about the Emerson situation, the premium, we had testimony we put in not only from, and again, we're not using any of our own testimony, the testimony from the buyers, for instance, Mr. Palazzolo, and from the representatives from the two principal suppliers, Phelps Dodge and Astarco, all of which said these premiums did fluctuate. It wasn't a hypothetical discount or adjustment.
Did they go into the negative territory?
Yes. They said that premiums would be adjusted downward based on what
was happening. Well, negative is different from downward.
Well, a negative, there was always the premium.
Less than zero.
No.
All right. That's what I'm trying to say.
But the premium was a number that would be adjusted upward or downward to reflect their views of the market. If there was testimony, if they thought the futures prices were getting out of whack, they would reduce what would otherwise be their profit to compensate for that. And so you have this integrated mess, if you will, of them doing forward pricing under different formulas in different quantities over a two-year period with a premium that was always negotiated that took into account.
And it was a tiny percentage, right, of the overall price, 2 cents out of, you know, a much larger number.
I understand that, and I appreciate that, Your Honor, but I want to focus on the record, and Judge Crabb looked at the only evidence that was put up was other than the contracts and these bland affidavits. There was no evidence put up by the appellants as to how they implemented those contracts, and we put in nothing.
Well, there's no way for the court to determine what percentage of the overall contracts involved self-refined cathode. I mean, wouldn't that have been enough to allow a quantification of damages?
Well, Your Honor, we were confronted with two problems. First, at a minimum, 39% and perhaps more because the records are just missing, but at least 39% of the copper was purchased by these suppliers from other sources before they were delivered. And it's probably more given the size of the claims they put in on the California settlement where they put in for $2 million of cathode.
Which means that 61% wasn't. You're running out of time, so I will either ask you or your colleague. Judge Cotton, you mentioned best parties.
Yes.
Putting together the positions in Loeb, in Ocean View, in your case, it seems to me that the bottom line is that your clients think that no one who bought copper should be able to bring this antitrust lawsuit. There are, in fact, no purchasers of physical copper. And if I'm wrong about that, then who purchased physical copper would ever be able to bring this lawsuit?
Under Illinois BRIC, the people who purchased physical copper from either Sumitomo or Global have absolute rights to bring an action
for
damages.
But let's focus on the futures traders. If the
futures traders definitely had a right
dealt
to.
With, no. I'm saying this wrong because I'm in a hurry.
Okay.
The conspiracy is an allegation of manipulation of prices on the futures market.
Mm-hmm.
Futures traders themselves trade contracts.
Yes.
They don't trade chunks of copper. The contracts represent chunks of copper that might be delivered at some point unless the contract itself gets traded or set off against something else. But I'm concerned that the net result of your position is that no one gets to bring this antitrust lawsuit, which seems to me an extreme position. So if we're looking for the best parties, maybe they aren't perfect parties, but maybe they're the best.
The best parties, Your Honor, are because Illinois BRIC applies here with equal force, the purchasers from Global Sumitomo, and on the futures side.
There's no distribution chain, though, from futures traders to physical copper buyers.
As Mr. Smith told you, both Global and Sumitomo are physical merchants. They sold cathode.
But not when we focus on, I mean, they may have, and maybe they had a different conspiracy that we should be looking at. But what about this futures market conspiracy?
Well, I can say, and the futures market, we had an action that was brought that was settled before Judge Pollack in the Southern District. Where there was over.
Those are the futures traders, though, and they have a different kind of injury from the people who bought.
But they
the
also,
copper.
And then there's also the futures traders on the London Metal Exchange, where they do. That is a market where parties actively, because it's a commercial market, actively take delivery of copper warrants. And that's part of his conspiracy that we were taking delivery of copper warrants and thus affecting the price of the physical copper. But both parties are active participants. All the conduct that we're talking about, every allegation in the complaint, relates to trading on the LME and the use of LME warrants.
Let me get this right straight. Are you admitting that there was sufficient evidence in the record to support the claim that the scheme wasn't limited to the foreign futures exchange, but targeted the price of physical cathode as well?
Your Honor, for the purposes of this motion, we did not controvert the issue of intent. We acknowledged that there was evidence that was in dispute about the issue of intent. As to every other element of the factors under Associated General Contractors.
So the answer is yes?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
But we did not controvert there. We focused instead on the causation issues, which the court and AGC and the courts applying have said the intent issue is the minor thing. It's the tail that wags the dog. You have to look at the directness. And here we have a terribly complex problem. I'd like to just make a couple of last observations since I'm in my last minute, Your Honor, if I may. And that is about the notion of Illinois BRIC here. Because AGC definitely does look at who's the best purchaser when you're balancing the factors. But a separate and independent test, as this court said in the Teamsters decision, both AGC and Illinois BRIC must be satisfied. And as the court said in the brand name drug case, that Utilicorp makes it clear there can be no exceptions. And Utilicorp said, even if all the assumptions about Illinois BRIC don't apply in this particular case, there are no exceptions. It
but
must be applied.
But of course, you do have to find that somebody's an indirect purchaser. Illinois BRIC isn't triggered until you find an indirect purchaser. If you're the direct purchaser, you have the claim and no one else
but
does.
Even under Illinois BRIC, Your Honor, the umbrella standing test by most of the circuits, and implicitly when the brand names decision adopted the Third Circuit's decision in Midwest, rejected the notion of umbrella standing, which, tellingly, appellants abandoned, even though they offered it on their motion to dismiss defense as the basis for satisfying the Illinois BRIC problem. First purchaser goes to causation. It doesn't go to relationship. There must be the proximity under Illinois BRIC. Absent that, you don't even get to the AGC test. And my time is up, and I'll turn it
over. Do you have a last thought that you really...
Do I have a last thought, Your Honor?
Yes.
Only one.
I'm going to give you some extra time.
No, I appreciate that, Your Honor, and you're very kind. I just want to hark back to what Judge Crabb did here was a very careful review of the evidence. We put in to Judge Crabb nothing but documents and testimony from the appellants and their vendors, and all of them painted a picture of a very complex situation. appellants put in generalized affidavits, relied on the contracts, and unlike and like the Fifth Circuit in the Beef case, you have to look below the contracts to see how they were enforced. And the concerns that Judge Cudahy talked about are very much real here. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wolowitz. I'm going to give
you an extra minute.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
My name is Stephen Wolowitz, and I represent Appellee Credit Leone Rouse, which is alleged to have been a clearing broker for Sumitomo on the London Metal Exchange. In addition to the points addressed by Mr. Havlis, I would like to raise an additional reason why the District Court's judgment should be affirmed as to Credit Leone Rouse. Simply put, the appellant submitted no admissible evidence as to Credit Leone Rouse. None whatsoever. On this question of intent to manipulate the physical cathode market, which is a linchpin of the plaintiff's effort to satisfy the directness prong of AGC, the appellant submitted no admissible evidence as to any intent on the part of Credit Leone Rouse to manipulate any market anywhere.
Is it your position that there's then no admissible evidence that there was a conspiracy that included Credit Leone Rouse and that they were a co-conspirator in that conspiracy?
That's correct, Judge. There is no admissible evidence in this summary judgment record against Credit Leone Rouse on the question of intent or on the question of involvement in any conspiracy. There is no admissible evidence as to Credit Leone Rouse at all. Your Honor, they completely forgot about Credit Leone Rouse. They did not take a single deposition of CLR. Their purported submissions as to CLR, which they put in on reply in connection with their own motion for summary judgment, consisted of exhibits attached to a lawyer's affidavit, all of which were unauthenticated, and under this court's decision in the Marks case and the Wells decision, which we cited in our motion to strike before this court, as well as the Northern District of Illinois decision in the Mustafa case, they were required at the summary judgment stage to put in any evidence as to Credit Leone Rouse in admissible form.
Did the motion address, what was Credit Leone Rouse's motion for summary judgment? Was it focused on standing, or did you say there isn't any evidence in, let's say, a Matsushita sense, you know, to include us in this conspiracy?
It focused on standing, Your Honor.
In other words, did the district court have before her the argument that you are now making at the time she ruled, or are you just introducing this, you know, now?
We're not introducing this now, Your Honor. We introduced this argument to the district court in connection with our opposition to the plaintiff's summary judgment motion. These were simultaneous submissions.
Right.
We moved for summary judgment on standing. Plaintiffs moved for summary judgment on standing. They went to great lengths to try to put in before the district court evidence as to the intent of Sumitomo and of Global, because that was their effort to circumvent the lack of directness under AGC.
If you didn't move for summary judgment on that ground, they wouldn't have had any occasion to pull together their evidence that pertained precisely to Credit Leone Rouse.
Judge,
so there's I'm concerned from a procedural standpoint about how this may have gone forward.
From a procedural standpoint, Your Honor, they knew from the very beginning that they were moving on standing grounds and that we were moving on standing grounds. And if they had any hope of tainting CLR with the supposed intent of Sumitomo and Global, they had better submit evidence as to our involvement in the conspiracy, because they had no basis to simply allege intent without putting in evidence.
Which part of the AGC test do you think the conspiracy evidence should have pertained to?
On plaintiff's theory, Your Honor, it pertained to the question of intent. Their argument, as Mr. Smith made quite plain this morning, is that because the defendant supposedly had the intent to manipulate the physical cathode market in the U.S., their injury is sufficiently direct under AGC. It's the plaintiff's theory that we're attacking here, that if that's the linchpin of their argument, they have no such evidence of any intent as to CLR, and they can't simply rely upon an allegation of involvement in a conspiracy. This was the summary judgment stage. This was their theory under Greater Rockford, Your Honor. Even a non-movement plaintiff on our motion for summary judgment has the obligation to present sufficient evidence on each element of their case as to which they bear the burden of proof. And on standing, they bear the burden of proof. There's no dispute as to that. So they had the obligation at the summary judgment stage, which they couldn't have cured no matter what we had said in particular in our original motion papers, because they had no admissible evidence as to CLR. They took no depositions. They had nothing to authenticate any documents. And on reply, they submitted unauthenticated documents and newspaper articles, as a result of which there's a complete absence of evidence as to CLR.
I'd like to ask a question on a different subject. One of the things that Judge Kraft found defective in the plaintiff's case involved the apportionment of damages, so that they alleged they had to apply a statistical technique, and she said, well, that, they didn't tell me exactly what the statistical technique was. Now, if we affirm that, are we putting some kind of requirement to acquire antitrust standing that you have to prove your damages in advance? Isn't that going to be an unjustifiable burden to place on plaintiffs?
Judge Cudahy, I believe what the court below was saying, and I think what I would say in response to Your Honor's question, is that it is incumbent at the summary judgment stage when it comes to standing for the plaintiffs to show the court that there is a specific method by which apportionment is possible so as to alleviate concerns about the complexity of apportionment allocations, which AGC is concerned with. I see that I have almost no time or no time remaining, so if I could just finish off with the final thought on Illinois Brick.
Sure.
And that is that the plaintiffs, the appellants, make a startling admission in their reply brief before this court on page 16 in footnote 12 of their reply brief, in which they concede that the direct purchasers from Sumitomo would have standing on this claim in this case. There is a distinction between first purchasers from the mines, as plaintiffs would have it, even though the court found they could not prove that, and direct purchasers from the defendants and their alleged co-conspirators. They are not direct purchasers. They concede they are not. And Illinois Brick and every other decision handed down by the Supreme Court and this court maintain that where there are direct purchasers, only those direct purchasers have standing. They've conceded that those direct purchasers do here. There would therefore absolutely be duplicative recoveries by their own admission between their claims and the direct purchasers from Sumitomo. Sanner, I would lastly proffer, is a completely different kind of case, because there were no defendants selling a product into a chain of distribution, whereas that absolutely is the case in this situation and in Illinois Brick.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time does Mr. Smith have? 2 minutes, add another three, please. To the two that he has left.
Thank you, Ron. I was going to promise to be brief, but maybe now I don't have to. I'd like to address several of the arguments first raised by Mr. Havilas and address some of the questions that the court raised regarding where in the record there is support that the pricing terms were linked expressly to the exchange prices. I would invite the court to look at the affidavit of John McGill, the Westinghouse buyer, at paragraph 18, which is in the supplemental appendix submitted by appellants at 330. The supplemental affidavit of Matt Palazzolo at paragraph 5, that's in the supplemental appendix at 413. Those witnesses both testified that they were given the COMEX price as the only price that they could pay for the cathode that they purchased from suppliers, and they had no ability to negotiate that price. That is consistent with the affidavit testimony of Mr. Goetz, who was Exxon's marketer of both concentrate and cathode. And it is undisputed that there was a single price that these plaintiffs had to pay, and that was the price as published on the COMEX. With respect to the issue of premiums, Mr. Havilas made a remarkable comment. He said that there's testimony in this record that suppliers adjusted premiums downward if the market was out of whack. I invite the court
to look in this record, you will look in vain for any evidence in this record that that ever happened in the history of the copper cathode market. What you will find is the musings of two economists that in a supply-demand situation, independent of the copper market, the premium might be used to reflect, moved downwardly to reflect supply-demand considerations that get out of whack. The bottom line evidence in this record, however, is that never happened. I also invite you to review the deposition testimony of Ms. Akabani, the corporate representative of Sumitomo, that testified in reality in this market, premiums move directionally with price. When the price of copper cathode goes up, the premium goes up. It doesn't go down. And that is the unequivocal testimony in this record. Also, you can look at the affidavit testimony of Mr. Goetz. He also testifies that premium and cathode pricing in the exchange market are unrelated, and they do not, one is not used to lower or compensate for the other. With respect,
what do you have to say to Mr. Wolowitz's contention that there was absolutely no evidence connecting CLR to this conspiracy?
Well, Your Honor, on the, at the motion to dismiss stage, a number of documents which are in this supplemental appendix were presented that demonstrated that Credit Lyon A. Rouse conspired with Sumitomo Corporation to manipulate London metal exchange prices and enabled Sumitomo to benefit in the cash market as a result of that. There is also evidence in this record that Credit Lyon A. Rouse paid a fine to the London Metals Exchange for its role.
£100,000 fine.
That is the £100,000 fine. Additionally, Your Honor, Mr. Wolowitz did concede that Credit Lyon A. Rouse was given an opportunity to move for summary judgment on standing grounds on the absence of evidence of intent and conspiracy. It did not do so. The first time it raised the issue was in response to the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment, and we submitted evidence into the record in reply when given the first opportunity to do so, both on the linkage between LME prices and COMEX prices, as well as evidence on the issue of CLR's role in the conspiracy. Absent is any evidence, is any argument by CLR that they in any way exited this conspiracy under United States versus DePriest, or in any way made any effort to distance themselves from the conspiracy. I think it also is worth noting that the district court bifurcated discovery here. We were only enabled to conduct discovery on the issue of standing, not on the issue of the underlying conspiracy. We were prevented from doing that. That is why there's an absence of deposition testimony from CLR witnesses on this issue. Lastly, on the Illinois brick issue, which has been raised by counsel for the appellees, Sanner was confronted with the same issue this court is confronted with here, and that is a market manipulation scheme directed at a published exchange price. This is not the Illinois brick situation where you have two competitors conspiring to fix the price of a product and persons buying under the umbrella of that conspiracy. Here, you have a conspiracy that is targeted specifically at a published index price, and defendants that are using movement of that index price to profit. And it is a very cynical argument that Counsel for Global makes, because what he says is, well, you could sue, buyers from Global could sue Global for manipulation of the price of cathode it sold. What the record evidence demonstrates is Global sold all of the copper cathode to Sumitomo Corporation. In other words, it was not a competitor of Sumitomo Corporation in Illinois Brick sense. It was an enabler of Sumitomo Corporation. And Sumitomo Corporation, of course, sold in foreign markets and not in the United States. There is considerable evidence in this record that these defendants used the United States markets to manipulate exchange prices for copper cathode with the intent of benefiting in the cash market as a result of that. And you know, I can't recall which of you asked the question, but the defendant's position, in essence, is there is no one in the cash market that has standing to bring a claim. And if this court adopts the ruling of Judge Crabb, that is the net effect of that ruling. No one in the cash market has standing to bring an antitrust claim for a conspiracy that was directed specifically at that market by Sumitomo Corporation, Global, and Credit Lyon A. Rouse as a co-conspirator. Thank you.
Well, thank you, one and all. And the case will be taken under advisement. And the court will take a short recess at this time.